is brought to you by Head Start Basketball.
Hi, this is Pat Baldwin, head men's basketball coach at the University of Wisconsin-Milwaukee, and you're listening to the Hoopheads podcast.
Hey, Hoopheads. Wanted to take a minute to shout out our partners and friends at Dr. Dish Basketball. We've had their partnership manager and training specialist, Jefferson Mason, and their marketing manager, Nick Bartlett, on the show in the past, and we couldn't be more excited about what they're doing for the game of basketball. Their Dr. Dish shooting machines are undoubtedly the most advanced and user-friendly machines on the market, and they truly accelerate skill development faster than ever. Beyond efficient reps, Dr. Dish provides training expertise and versatility designed to develop complete players. The new Dr. Dish CT machine has further revolutionized basketball training, with over 150-plus on-demand individual and team workouts from some of the best coaches and trainers in the game. These workouts include video instruction and combine game-like shooting drills with ball handling, conditioning, and agility drills. Along with workouts, the Dr. Dish training management system also provides stat tracking and analytics to track progress and ensure accountability. These are just a few reasons why top programs like Duke, North Carolina, Louisville, Florida, Baylor, and countless others are upgrading to Dr. Dish. Learn more at drdishbasketball.com and follow their incredible content at Dr. Dish B-Ball on Twitter, Instagram, Facebook, and YouTube. Mention the Hoopheads podcast and save an extra $300 on the Dr. Dish Rebel, All-Star, and CT models. Also, make sure to check out the new Dr. Dish Home Machine, which is perfect for these crazy times when gyms and schools are closed. Visit drdishbasketball.com for details. That's a great deal, Hoopheads. Get your Dr. Dish shooting machine today.
The hop is a better technique because you will get the shot off faster. So it's really, how good do you want to be? I always pose the question to my players, how good do you want to be? Look, you might be able to get away with the 1-2, but as you go up in levels, the players are going to get bigger and faster, and you might need to get this shot off a half second or a second faster, and you're going to need to do the hop. But it's good to know both, and usually speed determines it for the most part, but the hop is a more efficient technique.
Tim Hoyer is the founder of 180 Coaching, where he works with players of all ages to improve their shooting. Tim has coached at Saddlebrook High School, Woodbridge High School, and Foothill High School, along with other youth organizations in the state of California. In 2014, to help players improve their shooting, Tim developed the acronym SETRS, which stands for Stance, Eyes, Dip, Release, Sweep, and Sway. These shooting principles take into account Tim's study of some of the greatest shooters on the planet, along with some of the most current basketball shooting concepts, and combine them into one concentrated format that Tim uses to help players improve their shot. After you're done listening to this episode with Tim Hoyer, please leave us a 5-star rating and review on iTunes, and make sure you're subscribed so you never miss an episode. The Hoopheads Pod can be found on all the major podcast apps. Don't forget to let a friend or coaching colleague know about the show so we can continue to grow the great game of basketball. This episode is a great opportunity to learn from Tim Hoyer from 180 Coaching in Orange County, California. Hello, and welcome to the Hoopheads Podcast. It's Mike Klinzing here with my co-host, Jason Sunkel, and tonight we are pleased to welcome to the podcast from 180 Coaching, Tim Hoyer. Tim, welcome to the podcast.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
We are very excited to be able to have you on the show and dig into some of the unique shooting techniques that you are teaching. So I want to start out, though, by going back in time to when you were a kid and talk a little bit about how you got into the game of basketball when you were younger.
Yeah, great question. For the most part, it all came down to my father. My father played basketball in high school. He had opportunity to play in college. He instead decided to enroll at Rice University down in Houston, and he continued to play into his adulthood, and he would always take me along to his men's leagues games, and I'd watch him play and watch him score. And I'd just be on the sideline, and sometimes I'd have a basketball, and sometimes it would roll onto the floor, and they'd have to stop the game. And I from a very young age, you know, my dad would always take me to the park, and he would teach me how to play, and teach me how to dribble, and teach me how to do a layup. And I just kind of watched him, and I never really thought anything of it. I just kind of mimicked and did what he did, and I got into some basketball leagues, and. Just just started kind of my love for the game and my journey really all started from my father. He loved basketball and I didn't even question it. I just kind of did what he did and I became pretty good at it. So I just kind of followed in his footsteps.
What was it, is it about the game that you love? So once you got that influence from your dad and clearly you were indoctrinated into the game early by going and following him around and watching him play. But once you started playing yourself and developing that love for the game, what were some of the aspects of the game that you found appealing to yourself when you were younger?
Well, I think there were two aspects. One, obviously, was just, the main reason was it was a way for me and my father to relate, to talk, to spend time together, to shoot around, to strengthen our bond and our relationship. And it became a real father-son thing. I became pretty good at it. So that was also another thing, just getting kind of the admiration and from parents and from players, like, hey, you're pretty good at it. It just seemed to be very, very natural to me, from a very young age, I was halfway decent for a young kid.
No question. I think when you tend to have success, and this goes for anything, not just basketball or sports, but anything that you're good at, that you're getting positive reinforcement for, I think that usually leads to you wanting to do it more because you want to continue to seek that praise and continue to seek that admiration like you described. So if you think back to your high school playing days, what are one or two memories that stand out for you as a high school player?
Yeah, I think, I had a lot of adversity in high school, especially with my my senior year. I basically sat the whole, first quarter. I wouldn't play the first quarter, and I played strictly the second half, all of the second half. And I had some great games. I remember against our rival, which was played at the local junior college to seat all the stands. I remember I ended up having like 17 points, all in the second half of that game. And I remember specifically with my teammate, we were down, I think we were down by one, and they were pressing us. And I looked at my teammate and I was going to go deep. And I looked at him and I started shaking my head, like, don't throw the ball. And I could tell, because I'd played with him for 4 years, that he was going to throw me the ball. And I'm just shaking my head. I'm like, don't do it, because they had a safety back. Anyway, he throws me the ball. I try to tip it up, to tip it over the defender, but it went right to the defender anyway. In the crowd, I had it on tape. The whole crowd stands up. They're screaming. They're going crazy because they have an opportunity to take the lead. And the point guard is right behind him. The center intercepted it, and the point guard's coming. He's calling for the ball. And I just dart forward because I'm thinking, like, the center, he's just going to hand it off to the point guard. And that's exactly what he did. And I ended up stealing it, doing a reverse layup. We go up by three. We end up winning the game. But it was, looking back on tape, it was just a really cool moment that I got to share in because, the crowd's reaction, it was our rival game, and they got so, so happy, and the whole crowd was started cheering. And then 2 seconds later, I steal the ball and score a layup, and it just went silent. And, especially, for me, I had a really good game. I that always stands out for me. There are a couple other games, and most of them are the same things. Just me coming in the second half and just shooting the ball, just going crazy and just shooting the ball and scoring. I was averaging about 16 points a game. So me, 24, 16, something like that. I had a lot of memorable games like that.
I love the fact that your memory involves silencing a crowd, because I think that's one of my favorite things, both as a player, as a coach, as a fan. That as much fun as it is to be at a home game or to witness a home game where the crowd's going crazy and it's so loud, I always felt like there was as much satisfaction and joy in silencing a hostile visiting crowd as there was in pumping up and getting your own crowd excited. And then the question I wanted to ask you about your memory that you shared is, you mentioned a couple times that you have that memory on tape, or that you had it on tape and you would watch it. So when you go back and you think about that and you're processing that in your head to share that story with us tonight, are you seeing more of your own point of view through your own eyes, or are you seeing that memory through the tape, since you've probably obviously seen the tape more than you actually saw the actual event when it happened, which you only got to experience one time, and now you've probably seen the tape multiple times. So when you think about that memory, are you thinking about your point of view, or are you thinking about the memory that you see on the tape?
Mainly from the tape.
Yeah.
It was definitely from the tape. And there were, I remember my father had a bunch of tapes. I remember visiting him on like a year or two ago, and he had all the tapes. He had no TV, no cable. So I just had the old home movies, and I went through them. And there were some games. I there was this one game my junior year against that same rival. And I ended up scoring like, I don't know, I scored a lot. It was like 26, 29 points, something like that. And I had totally blocked out that game. Like, I didn't even remember it. And I was sitting there, and I'm like, because I was like, man, I have like 22, 24, 26. Like, this is a really big game. But the problem is, I think we ended up losing by like 12 or 15 points. And so I had totally blocked out that game, even though I played great. I mean, I had close to 30 points. I totally forgot about it. It was not even in my memory, didn't even register. And, you know, this other game, my senior year, you know, I score 17, like vivid in my memory. But I think you kind of like got me thinking. My second to last game was against Westlake, and it was 100-95 was the final score. And I remember it was kind of the same teammate. We had gone down by three with like a minute left, and most of the time, this teammate would kind of sulk and not do anything. But for this one time, I got the ball out of the net, and I made eye contact with him, and he just took off, and I threw the deep pass, and I hit him in stride. He got fouled. He made the shot. He made the layup. We were able to go into overtime, and we were able to win. But I remember us seeing the game. Like that game, we saw, all of us saw the game through the same pair of eyes. And we, you know, I felt really connected to my teammates at the end of my senior year, where we all kind of saw the game. Not all of us got along, but at that last, that was like, that could have been our last game as seniors. And I just remember like those last few minutes, how we were all on point in that we were going to play the best we could possibly play, because it might be our last.
Yeah, that's something that I think that we tend to underrate when we look back at our memories. And I've talked to a bunch of different coaches and different people, and obviously people have different types of memories, and some people remember specific plays out on the floor, and other people remember moments in the locker room or on the bus or with their teammates. And I think the memories that you've shared are kind of a nice mix of that, and that you remember clearly a play that you had a huge impact on the outcome of a game, which is fun, and you had the crowd and all that going along with it. And then the fact that you talked about the connection that you were able to make with your teammates, I think those are two things that are very, very important. And when we think about coaching, whether that's from a player development standpoint, like we're probably going to talk about tonight, or whether we're talking about being a high school or college coach, I think being able to impact your kids and your players where they have memories of what went on the floor, but even more importantly, they have memories of what went on with their teammates and sort of within the culture of a team. I think that's really, really important. It's cool that you're able to share both of those things. I have one question for you though. Have you taken those tapes and have you converted those into DVD or digital files, so those things don't end up disappearing from history forever? You got to get those things protected.
Yeah, that's a good question. Actually, no, I haven't done it. They're just
you got to do it.
They're
sitting
in a box.
Tim.
Yeah, I do.
You got to do it.
Yeah.
That's one of the things. It's funny because I had, my dad had tons of video from when I was playing. And at some point, probably one of the nicest things that he ever did for me was to create DVDs of all those old VHS tapes that I can now go back and look at and play. And not that I'm sitting around looking at those all the time, but it's nice to have them in your back pocket where if you ever want to look at them or you ever want to show them to your kids or somebody at some point is interested or asks you a question, you can go back and find it. And so that's one of the nicest things that my dad's ever done for me. So I think if you get an opportunity to do it, you want to do it sooner rather than later before those things completely deteriorate.
Yeah, you're absolutely right.
All right, so moving on from playing, let's talk a little bit about your story after high school. When did you start thinking about getting involved in coaching and start thinking about shooting and how you wanted to get involved and be able to impact players in a way that you were impacted as a young kid?
Well, it was much later. It wasn't until I was in my 30s, till I had stopped really playing. Shoot around here and there. But I wasn't. The way I got into coaching is kind of funny, because it wasn't typical. I wasn't trying to become a coach. I was watching my brother play, and he was 8, and he had been playing in this league since he was 7. And I was getting really mad, and I was getting frustrated, and I got so upset that I walked out of the gym. And at the end of the practice, I went to my mother and I said, "Mom, what is going on? My brother's been in this league for over a year. I don't think he can even dribble a basketball. Like, what are you guys doing?" And my mom was like, "Well, Tim, you know, your father taught you. He doesn't have you or dad. You can work with them while you're here for a week. But if you think you can do better, then when you go back to California, why don't you volunteer and coach?" And so I worked with my brother, and he never did anything in these games. And I went to him. I said, "Look, man, I can't do anything. You're going to have to work on defense. That's going to be your specialty." And I had one of his friends come over, and I told him how to get into a stance. And I basically told him to get wide. And I told him, "At your age, just if you get into a stance, kids are going to pick up the ball, grab it with two hands, and rip it out of their hands." And he went into the next game, and the kid that just sat in the corner and never did anything, and he had like 11 steals. And parents were noticing this, and they're like, "What has gotten into this kid?" And then the best players on the team were like, "If this kid can do it, then I can do it." And so they all started copying him. He ended up guarding the best player on the team, and he really started to contribute, and he really started to pick up, and really started to I think, kind of love the game at that point, because he was getting, positive reinforcement. Anyway, I came back to Costa Mesa, Newport Beach area, and I volunteered at the YMCA, and they needed volunteer coaches, and so I volunteered. And it was probably the best experience. Now, looking back on my whole coaching career, that was the purest form of basketball that I was able to experience, were those first 5 years coaching for free at the Y.
So what do you remember? What did you love about that? Because obviously you're doing that. When we think about coaches, especially at the youth level, we're thinking about coaches who have a kid on the team. And that's typically what happens. So what was it about coaching at that level that excited you, that made you want to come back day after day, year after year? What satisfaction were you getting? What did you feel like you were contributing during those 5 years while you were coaching as a youth coach?
Well, I mean, I grew up as an only child, now that I have brothers, and I practice all the time. And I just found out I had a lot of, well, to most people, a lot of useless information about basketball and how to train and get better. Like, I don't use that anymore, but I have it. But I just was, when I was working with my brother and working with some of his friends, I started realizing, like, man, I know a lot more about basketball than all these people. Like, this is just really common sense stuff. Like, I'm not even, this isn't anything new. So the best part about coaching at the Y was, I always laugh because I hear it all the time. Like, coaches are like, "Okay, you got to have a practice plan. Plan out your practices. Write everything in super detail. Make sure you have it." I've still never written out a practice plan. Every time I write out a practice plan, it goes horribly wrong. And at the Y, the best thing that made me a coach was the fact that I didn't even get to coach 5 players at once for 2 to 3 years into my coaching career. Like, I would show up and 2 or 3 kids would show up, and I would just coach, and I couldn't do any team stuff. I had to do individual work. And they were 6 and 7s. Then I moved up to 8, 9s, then 10 and 11s. Then I started coaching 2 teams. Then it came into 3 teams. Then it came into 3 teams and private lessons. And it just slowly built. A lot of coaches, they're given varsity programs or college programs right from their first coaching experience. I was lucky and privileged enough not to have that. And it really enabled me to really fine tune my philosophy and see what really worked with players that were unskilled and very, very new and very, very young. And I wouldn't change it for the world. And I wish that more coaches got that experience of coaching 1 or 2 players and then moving to 3 or 5 and then 6 or 7 and then finally getting a team, you know, together. It's a unique and I think a very worthwhile experience.
Yeah, I think that's an interesting path that you don't often hear of. I do think that there are a lot of coaches who maybe are not at the age that you were when you started coaching, but we have talked to coaches who have started out as college freshmen and they get an opportunity to coach at the local Y or be a volunteer, and that kind of hooks them on coaching. And one of the things that you always hear is that if you can teach it to a 6-year-old or a 7-year-old or an 8-year-old or a group of 6, 7, and 8-year-olds, then it should be easy to be able to teach it to someone who's a little bit older, has a little bit more skill, a little bit more sophisticated. And I think there's definitely something to be said for that. I know I spend a lot of my time as a coach working with elementary school kids because that's the age group that I teach all day. And then it's also the age group that the camps that I've been running for 28 years have been primarily focused on elementary school age kids. So I think that I can relate to your story in that a lot of times I am working with kids who are not that skilled, or it's their first time experience with the game, or maybe they're a pretty good player, but they're still only 8 years old. And so there's lots of opportunity for you to teach and learn and figure out what works and what doesn't.
Yeah.
And then I also think there has to be a certain mentality, a certain approach that you have with kids of that age and that skill level. So can you talk a little about what maybe what your approach was in terms of how you interacted and tried to set up your skill development for those younger kids when you first started?
Yeah. I mean, what I tell people, and I've shared this before with people at camps and clinics, was like at that young age, really dribbling is the foundation. And I wanted to make sure that anyone that I coached, you know, especially between, you know, 10 or under, like they looked like they picked up a basketball. I ended up buying my own basketballs for the kids so that each kid would have at least 2 basketballs per kid. And I remember the main thing that I learned too was to be efficient with my time and with the gym. So a lot of times I'd get a half court, I'd have 3 baskets, and I set up some kind of circuit where, you know, maybe they take 1 ball or 2 balls depending on their skill level, and maybe dribble through an agility ladder, go through some cones. But they kind of just go in a circle and they never stop. And they just do that for like 2 or 3 minutes. Typically I like to do it with 2 balls because that way it's a better efficient use of their time. And it develops both the left and the right hand. And I remember one time I went through this kind of circuit with these 8, 9-year-olds. And I filmed it. It's somewhere on YouTube. And it's funny because it's like, I'm doing it. I'm showing the kids. And every time I show it to somebody, they always look at me like, those kids can't do that. That's crazy. Like, what are you doing? And then they do it. And, you know, just staying positive with the kids and just showing them stuff and just allowing them to screw up. And if they screw up, don't make a really big deal about it. Just say, hey, man, don't worry. Just keep going. You know, you don't have to coach them. You don't have to tell them that they screwed up. They know. They're trying not to, but just stay positive and just keep it short and light. But dribbling is the main thing because the kids that can't dribble in at a very young age, the other kids know it. And it's like sharks feeding. And if you can't dribble, then me as a defender, I want to attack you because I want to try to steal the ball because I have no fear that you're going to drive around me and score. And if I don't have any fear, then there's nothing. Why wouldn't I go and try to steal the ball from you? But once I try to steal the ball and you dribble around me and get a layup, now I'm going to back off and now I'm going to allow you to pass. And that's just a really simple, basic concept, but it's something that I always make sure that all of my players know how to dribble. And we work on dribbling a lot in the beginning stages.
All right. So there's 3 things I want to pull out from what you just said that I agree with 100%. One is the importance of a kid being able to dribble and handle the ball at a very young age. If you learn how to dribble the ball and control it at a very young age, then you can get wherever you want to go on the court. So many people, we all know that kids love to shoot the ball. That's the first thing that attracts everybody to the game. Unfortunately, in a lot of instances, kids are shooting on baskets that are 10 feet. So the same basket that 6'8", 260-pound LeBron James is shooting on, the 3'9", 7-year-old is shooting on that same basket with
terrible form and having to chuck the ball up and do all these things just to get the ball up to the basket so it has a chance of going in. So one of the things that I really believe is that at those younger ages, just like you, that the more you can focus on having that ball in the kids' hands and work on developing their ball handling and their dribbling, the better off they're going to be. I agree with you 100%. Second thing I agree with 100% is how you talked about having a ball, or in your case, sometimes two basketballs in your kids' hands during your practices all the time. I think the more you can have a ball in a kid's hand, especially at those young ages, the better off you're going to be. One of the things that I'm a huge believer in when it comes to working with youth basketball, whether that's in a team practice setting, whether it's in a camp, whether it's in a training session, is you don't want to have kids standing around in lines watching. You want to have them doing, because A, doing helps them to improve their skill, and B, doing is a lot more fun than standing and either listening to a coach or watching somebody else do something. So that's something else that I completely agree with. And then I think the last part of it that you talked about, which is very important, is just the need for that constant activity. And so by moving them through stations where, okay, here's a group doing this, and then you've got another thing set up at this basket, another thing set up here, and it's sort of a circuit that they're moving through, that keeps them going all the time, short bursts, 2-3 minutes, and then you move on to doing whatever, a different skill or a different set of circuits or whatever it might be. So I think those are all great things that you have set up. And as you started thinking about putting together those skill development, what ended up being skill developments, because you were only getting 2 or 3 kids out of your entire Y team to show up at any one time, and you start developing your coaching philosophy, over the course of that 5 years, when did you start thinking about, hey, when did you start to develop a formal process for thinking about how you wanted to coach, and maybe started to think about what was eventually going to become 180 coaching? Were you thinking about that at this point, at this stage in your career, or were you still just doing it because you just love being in the gym with those kids?
I really enjoyed being in the gym with the kids. It was a way for me to give back and be more kind of selfless and just share a lot of information that just came, you know, natural to me that I didn't really have to think about. But I also learned a lot because I was always researching and trying to figure out new ways, new techniques. I would sometimes videotape my practices and then go back and go. The whole circuit training idea came because we were working on the main gym or on the main basket, and there were 2 baskets to the left and to the right side of me. And I was watching myself, and I'm very hard on myself. And I was like, you know, these kids are doing this drill, but after they do the drill, they could just branch off and then maybe go shoot a layup on the other 2 baskets to the left and to the right, or do some other kind of drill or some kind of other skill development, and then come back into the line and just kind of, you know, kind of go in that pattern. And, you know, that kind of changed the way I kind of saw the game, just being more efficient with everything. I always try to use every single basket. If I'm given 6 baskets, I try to create drills that are continuous, that use every single basket. And I try to give everyone a ball. My basketball philosophy, though, it changed because I got different teams. And every time I thought I figured it out, I would get a team that philosophy didn't work with them. Right?
Welcome to coaching, right, Tim?
Yeah. Yeah, exactly. And, you know, I just had to adapt. I tried to make plans. I mean, even in high school, fast forward even to high school, I remember making this plan. It was so perfect. I planned out the perfect practice, of course. And I get to the gym, and the varsity coach is like, hey, man, we're in. And the whole practice was me doing full court, press, break, you know, press, break, a secondary break, all full court, fast break stuff. And I get to the gym, and he's like, oh, we're sharing the court, so you just get that half court. And right there, I just like crinkled up my whole plan I had spent like 30 minutes to an hour on, and just threw it in the garbage because I just started laughing. I'm like, yeah, that figures. And every time I try to plan something at the Y or in high school or wherever, something would always come up, and I couldn't do it. And so I'd have to think on the, you know, I'd have to coach on the fly. And, you know, just being okay with that. You know, everyone has a plan, right? Or what is that saying by Mike Tyson?
That's the Mike Tyson. Everybody has a plan until you get punched in the jaw.
Yeah, exactly. So that happened to me a lot in my early coaching career.
Head Start Basketball, along with members of the Jay Billis Skills Camp staff, will be hosting the very first Prime Skills Camp, an affiliate of the Jay Billis Skills Camp that is held annually in Charlotte, North Carolina. Prime Skills Camp will take place on the campus of Western Reserve Academy, just outside of Cleveland, Ohio, June 26th through the 28th, and will be designed for boys rising to grades 6 through 9. Prime Skills Camp will mirror the Jay Billis Skills Camp in daily programming, teaching, coach-to-camper ratio, and quality of instruction. Prime Skills Camp brings all of the team-oriented individual instruction, focus on the fundamentals, and high-level coaching to young men aspiring to a high school varsity basketball experience. This camp is operated by Billis Camp veterans and includes the Jay Billis Coaches Development Program alongside the camp, ensuring that the quality of teaching and coaching at this camp is second to none. Please visit headstartbasketball.com or jaybilliscamp.com for more information or to get registered.
Especially when you're coaching youth basketball, I think that's a huge issue for youth coaches all across the country, is that when you show up for a practice, you never have any idea how much of a gym you're going to have. And I know I've been in that situation many times myself, where I've put together a plan of what I wanted to do and had some drills thought out that I thought I was going to end up with a full court and ended up that all I had was a half court, or vice versa. I thought I was going to only have a half court and they end up having a full court. And then I think, as you said, that ability to improvise on your feet is something that the best coaches, and I'll take it one step further, the best coaches or the best teachers also do that as well, is you have to be able to adjust to what's going on in your lesson or what's going on in your practice and be able to pivot if things aren't going the way you expect, or you don't have the materials you expected, or you don't have the space that you expected. And to me, that's a hallmark of somebody who's a good coach, who, yes, you have a plan, but then you're able to adjust it depending upon what the circumstances may dictate. And that's a huge, huge thing, I think, for youth coaches, is to be able to have an idea of, okay, well, we might have a full court, we might have a half court, maybe we're only going to have one basket, maybe we're going to have three baskets, maybe we're going to be sharing the court with another team. Sometimes you show up and you have no idea what to expect. And so I think that ability to think on your feet is one that I'm sure has served you well throughout the time when you've been coaching.
Yeah, I think one of the things, when you were talking, it kind of reminded me of one of my biggest mistakes coaching in early in my coaching career. And it's one that all coaches, I think at some point, every coach does this. And I remember doing it. I kind of thank God it was on the, it was early in my career. But basically, and everyone's going to kind of nod their head, I hope, making things too complicated. So putting in an offense that's too complicated for the talent that you have. And I noticed that when I went into my high school career and stuff like that with other coaches, sometimes I would sit there and I'd go, man, our players aren't as talented and our offense is more complex. And that's a dangerous situation to be in, because you need to make things, if your players are less talented, the offense and the defensive schemes need to be easier to make the game easier for them. But you can put your team behind the eight ball by coaching a very strict and disciplined way, or if you try to run an offense that has a lot of reads and a lot of counters and a lot of thinking, you can handicap your team by making the offense too complicated, or defense. But in my case, it was the offense.
Yeah, I agree with you there 100%. I agree. I think one of the things there's two things that come to mind when you said that. One is, I think especially at the youth level, if you're going to spend any time putting in something that's complicated with players who are not that experienced of basketball players, you're going to spend a lot of time working on set plays. And I mean, like half of your practice is going to be spent just trying to get kids to remember what spots to be in. And clearly that's not a good use of your time in a youth practice. You're much better off doing what you described, which is put the kids in a skill development session where they're actually becoming more skilled at the game. And as they become more skilled at the game, then they can be involved in things that are a little bit more sophisticated. And yet, I'll take it one step further. We had on a month or two back, we had on Mike Procopio, who was Kobe Bryant's personal coach for a while, where Kobe would have him scouting opponents, and then Mike would send back his scouting report to Kobe so that Kobe could be better prepared for each one of his games. And then Mike's worked for the Mavericks, and he's worked with a bunch of great coaches. But Mike shared on the podcast, one of his taglines is dominate simple. And what he explained to us was that when he's coaching the NBA, he goes, there's really only 25 guys in the whole league that really matter, that get plays called for them, that get things run for them, that can pretty much do whatever they want. And this is at the highest level of the game. And the other 350 players in the league are basically role players. And what they have to figure out is, what do they do well? What are the one or two or three things that they do well, and just dominate those few simple things? And I think a lot of times we try to overburden players at all levels and teach them a million different things. Whereas, as you said, if you can simplify it and make it easy, then you're going to end up probably having more success. And I just love that saying that Mike has, dominate simple. To me, it's something that is easy to be able to explain to a coach or to a player. Hey, this is easy, it's simple, but we've got to dominate that. We've got to be great at it. And I think that's kind of the point that you're getting at.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, absolutely. That's 100% correct. You got to keep things very, very simple. And I know that a lot of times in my coaching career, like, I put a big emphasis, especially on younger kids, about transition. And I would always tell them, like, hey, we got to score. We got to go and score as soon as possible. Get the ball. It doesn't matter. You guys are all point guards. So if you get the rebound, just start dribbling. Don't wait to go. And I remember I would say things. I remember early on, it would be weird because I'd be at the Y and a kid would get the ball and he'd be okay, or maybe he wasn't that good. And he would go and I would just go, attack, attack, go, 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 go. And he would go and maybe he would dribble the ball off his leg at half court. And he'd kind of look a little sad. And I'd bring him over and I'd go, hey, that was great. Okay. But on this next play, let's see if you can't get to the 3-point line. Right. And I would always just, I would encourage him, like, hey, that's okay. You dribbled it off your leg. That was expected. But now let's just try to get past half court. Let's try to get to the 3-point line. Let's try to get to the free throw line. Let's try to get a layup, you know, and just encourage them to just go a little bit further in their progression. And then also, I remember at the high school level, I remember in my last high school stint, I divided the teams up and I said, okay, team A, you guys did great. You ran the offense precisely just how we coached it, and you got most of your points out of the half court set. Team B, you guys looked horrible on offense, didn't really run anything, scored very, very few points in the half court set, but you scored a lot in fast breaks. And I would go to team A and I go, team A, you did very well in the half court set. What did that get you? And they're like, we lost, coach. And I go, that's right, because fast break is the name of the game and you got to get up and down, right? Don't put this on my shoulders, because if we got to score in the half court set, we need to score 80, 90% of our points in transition. And then when we get stopped, then it's on me and we got to design something. And so I would always say that, don't take the game out of my hands, right? In transition, that's where you have the most freedom and creativity to be you. So, and you have an advantage. You know, really attack. I want you to really push it in those circumstances.
Yeah, I love that about the transition. Also, the other thing that I love that you said, which I think is one of the tenets of positive coaching, and that is, when a kid makes a mistake, if they're trying to do something that you want them to do, or they're trying to perform a skill that they're just learning but they haven't perfected, you have to recognize and acknowledge their effort and not just the results. So when, in the example that you gave, when the kid's dribbling the ball up the floor after he gets the rebound, maybe he's not the best dribbler on the team. Maybe another coach, as soon as he got the rebound, would have been yelling and screaming, hey, give it to Johnny, give it to Johnny, give it to Johnny. Instead, you're encouraging that kid to dribble the ball up the floor. And then he doesn't get the result that he wanted. You didn't get the result that you wanted, which was him dribbling the ball up the floor and either scoring or making a pass. Instead, he dribbles it off his foot. But the key here is that he was doing what you asked him to do. He was trying to stretch beyond what the current limits of his skill were. And you, as the coach, instead of pointing that out as an error, a mistake, and saying, what are you doing? Instead, you said, hey, that's a great job. I love that you're trying to bring the ball up the floor. Fantastic. Next time, I want you to try to get it 10 more feet further, or whatever the case might be. And by acknowledging that effort and by recognizing the kid stepping out of his comfort zone and trying to do something beyond what his current limits are, that's how you encourage that behavior to continue. And I think that that's something that is critically important at all levels of coaching, but I think it's especially important with young, impressionable players who are in elementary school. If you are going to criticize them when they try something new or when they try something difficult, you're going to eventually shut them down to the point where they're not even going to want to try. And so I think that what you're saying, the philosophy that you're describing, are things that any youth coach out there can learn from, in that you want to praise the effort and not just the result. So I think that's a great job that you're doing there, Tim.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And I used to always rotate my point guards, like, you know, especially after out of bounds plays or made baskets, I would say, okay, you know, Sam, you brought it up the last three times, switch it up, have somebody else bring it up. And, you know, and if they're not very good, I would, you know, I'd let them bring it up three or four times. And if they turn the ball over, I wouldn't get mad, but then I would switch it to another player. Because if you watch any youth sports, you will notice that there's usually one player, it's typically the coach's son, who brings the ball up every possession and he gets all the reps. And I wanted to make sure that if my philosophy, if you want to get down to like the one word, it's growth. And you could also call it, you know, change. There's a lot of different words you can do it, but I want people to be constantly improving, right? Or constantly growing. And you got to do that through the reps and getting different players, you know, different reps. And especially at the youth level, I mean, no one remembers what they did when they were 7 years old or 9 years old or 10 years old. Like, those games don't count. Like, no one cares, right? Winning's not the goal. Right, the goal.
Moms and dads sometimes care.
Yes,
in the moment.
Yes,
for sure they care, and that's something that I think if we could get across. And we've talked about this a little bit on the podcast, but not tremendously because we haven't always had this youth basketball discussion that you and I are having tonight. But I think it's important for parents out there, if you are the parent of a basketball player at any level, it's important to remember that you're 100% right, Tim. That no one is going to remember or care about the score of a 7-year-old's basketball game. It's just not going to be that important, trust me. And ultimately, what you're looking for is a positive experience for your kid where they're having fun, they're developing a love for the game, and they're learning something in the process of doing that. And all that's being done with positive coaching. And that's all the things that you're describing are all things that if I was a parent, those would be the type of coaches and the types of programs that I would be seeking out to have my kid get their basketball experience with.
And look, I mean, I want to win just like everybody else.
Absolutely.
I don't emphasize it, because once you start focusing on the goal, you start missing everything in between. And, you know, the reality is if you, you know, if you're 10, you know, a lot of times you have to win to kind of, you know, to some degree, just so that people, even more credible, people listen to what you have to say. But even if you lose every game, which I've done, you know, those teams are typically developing teams. So it doesn't matter what you do, you're probably going to lose the majority of those games. But you want to make sure that everyone's getting better. You know, that's always the goal. Like, your team and your team record will always be better if everybody's improving, you know?
Absolutely. I think that sometimes we forget and we think as coaches that it's our genius that leads to the success of our teams, when more often than not, it's the more skilled team that ends up winning games. And I think that goes from all levels of basketball. And so I think that one of the number one things that a coach can do is to develop their player's skill. And it's important, no matter what level of basketball you're coaching, that some part of your practices every single day. And different coaches are going to have different philosophies, but my philosophy would definitely be that every single day, skill development has to be baked in as part of your practice. And I think if you're not including skill development, if all you're working on is set plays and your strategy, even at the high school or college level, I think you're doing your players a disservice. And at the youth level, clearly you're doing your players a disservice. If you're spending more than 5 minutes of practice just teaching them one basic out of bounds play and maybe how to enter the ball on the wing, if you're teaching any more than that, you're wasting a lot of your time that could be spent developing your kids into better basketball players, which ultimately is going to help them more than whether or not they remember your 42 set plays.
Yes, exactly. I totally agree.
All right, let's start looking at and talking about your philosophies on shooting. So share a little bit first the background of how you started coming up with your ideas and thoughts about how to teach shooting. And then let's go into a little bit of your methodology and how you go about teaching that to players today.
Okay. Yeah. The reason I didn't even teach shooting for the first couple of years. It's a difficult skill to teach. I ended up doing it. It all came down to a simple question. I always think of Jared Diamond, who's this author of Guns, Germs, and Steel. He wrote this this award-winning book because basically someone asked him, why did he bring so much cargo on this trip? And then that started this journey where he wrote this book called Guns, Germs, and Steel. That's what happened with me. Basically, I was teaching, and there was a little bit of frustration because I at the time I was melding a bunch of different ideas, this philosophy, that philosophy, my own personal experience, and I was kind of meshing them together. And I was training a player, and we were in a discussion about, I was teaching him index finger in the middle of the ball. And his coach was suggesting either split finger or middle finger. I can't remember exactly, but I ended up telling him, like, hey, man, regardless of what I say, you should go on YouTube and study the best players on the planet and see what they do and do that. And a couple nights later, I said, I should listen to my own advice. And I did that. And what I found out blew my mind. I was looking at a picture of Ray Allen, and it was a frame-by-frame shot of him shooting the ball, frame-by-frame, still pictures. And halfway through his shot, I'm looking at him, and I'm seeing the back of his hand. And I'm like, he's holding that ball on the side. And that blew me away. Like, I'm seeing, you know, because I'm on the side angle, I'm seeing the back of his hand. And all my coaches and everybody that taught me shooting had always taught me, basically, put your hand behind the ball and, you know, middle finger, split finger, middle finger, you know, one of those aspects. And I'm watching Ray Allen, who at the time was the best shooter on the planet, and I noticed he didn't do it. And then I looked at Steph, and I noticed he didn't do it. And I was, like, blown away, and I was like, wow. And then I remember it was 3 a.m, and I was putting my hand on the side of the ball, and I was rotating my palm, and I was thinking, like, oh, my gosh, my elbows are staying in. Everything seems really simple and it seems super easy. I almost went to the court that night just to try it out. And I ended up going the next morning. But it was something that really blew me away. And from that question, I started looking at more and more tape, researching more and more about shooting. And I got frustrated because I liked this aspect or what this guy said. And I liked what this guy said. And I kept telling myself, man, why doesn't someone just put all this great information together? Because I'm kind of mixing and combining. And eventually I just said, you know what? I'm going to do it. Because and at least it'll help me develop my own philosophy on the game. And so I basically took what I thought were the biggest components. And I think people get lost, especially in the shooting realm, on what to focus on and what not to focus on. And I have a specific reason on exactly why I teach a certain concept. There is a well thought out answer. Most of it has to do with ADA, A-D-A, and in shot uniformity. So
all right, explain those two concepts to us.
Okay, the ADA is based off the Sloan Analytics Conference. So every year in Boston, There's an analytics conference, and there was a paper, and basically it broke down shooting. It took over like a million shots. It took like, I don't know, it was over a million shots from high school, from college, and then in the pros. And it took all this information and it basically said the only thing that matters when you shoot is ADA, which is alignment, D is for shot depth, and A is for arc. And it said, and that's all that matters. In shooting, those are the only things that matter. That those are the biggest, big stone, largest components. And everything that I train is for those concepts, or those concepts in particular. The other thing is shot uniformity. How do I understand if what I'm teaching is actually true? I picked out, and I'll share my concepts later, but I picked out a set of principles, a set of concepts, and I applied them to every type of shot. Now, I did this I did it initially to prove myself wrong. So I took a concept and I applied it to an underhand granny shot, to a fadeaway jumper, to a free throw, to a three-point shot, and then eventually to a sky hook. And I also compared it to how people shoot when they're in a wheelchair. Because shooting is shooting. Whether you're shooting a basketball in a wheelchair, if you're shooting in a sky hook, if you're shooting a jumper, if you're shooting a free throw, shooting is shooting. And there has to be some underlining universally true principles that it doesn't matter what type of shot you have. And so if I teach a concept, it falls in that ADA category, and then I apply it to every shot. And if it works in every type of shot, then I tell myself, this has to be true. This has to be true. And so that's what I use.
So then you've come up with the acronym SEDRS.
Yes. I call it setters.
Setters. Got it. Okay. So explain to us, A, what that means. Give us what each of those letters stand for. And then kind of go through them one at a time and how they apply to every single type of shot.
Okay. All right. Great question. Okay. So the setter stands for stance, eyes, dip, release, and then sweep and sway. And the first one is stance. And stance just basically talks about how do I hold the ball and how do I stand, right? Just basically, how do I hold the ball? And like I said earlier, people talk about middle finger, split finger, or index finger. And I've been to a lot of camps, and I went to this very, very well-known camp. I don't want to say which one it was, but everyone knows it. It's very, very popular. I'll say it's a top five camp in the nation. And I remember they were talking about index finger, and I was kind of being a brat, because I knew the hiccups within that philosophy because I'd experienced them. And here's one thing: when people or shooting coaches tell me index finger, split finger, or middle finger, and why I don't agree, and why I always teach hand on the side of the ball, it goes back to two things. It goes back to shot uniformity, and the second thing it goes to is dominant eye. So, would you teach a 6 or 7 year old when he shoots a layup to put his middle finger or index finger in the middle of the ball? No. You would just tell him, hold the ball, you know, take your 1-2 step and then rotate your palm. You know, you rotate it under and do an underhand layup, or rotate it over and do an overhand layup. You know, if I did a fadeaway jumper, am I putting my index finger in the middle of the ball? No. You know, I'm holding it from the side. People are swiping at it. I need to have good control. I'm probably doing a shimmy. If I'm shooting an underhand free throw, would I put my index finger in the middle of the ball or my middle finger in the ball? No, I'm shooting through both eyes and both my hands are on the side. Again, they rotate to the top of the ball. You know, when I'm doing a hook shot, I would never put any of these shots, I would never put my index finger in the middle of the ball. I would just grab the ball from the side and I would just rotate my palm. And that's part of the shot uniformity. The other part is dominant eye. I'm from Texas, so I shot a pistol when I was a young age, and that's pistols, pool, darts. These are other targeting sports, and these sports utilize your dominant eye. About 15% of the population is cross-eyed dominant, meaning if I'm right-handed, I'm right-eye dominant and right-handed. But I've had players that are left-eye dominant, but they're right-handed. And if you don't know that going in, your set of principles will not work. Okay? So if you put index finger in the middle of the ball and you try to, which is fine if you're right eye dominant, but if you have to shoot through your left eye, now that ball goes a little bit over to the left side of your body. And what you're going to notice is your elbow is going to flare out, and it's going to be much more a little bit harder to hold the ball. Obviously, if you have huge hands, it becomes a little bit easier, but it's much easier to hold the ball and shoot through the middle of your forehead or your dominant eye, even if it's on the opposite side, if your hand is on the side of the ball. Stance, you don't want to be square. I mean, you can start square, but you will never, ever finish square. Again, shot uniformity. When you shoot a layup, are you square? No, your shoulders are turned. When you shoot a fadeaway, you're not square. When you shoot a hook shot, your shoulders are not square, right? The only time they're square is actually with an underhand free throw. And that's because you're shooting through both hands equally and both eyes. So you need to line those, your hips and your shoulders, to the basket. But every other shot, you're not. And here's another thing. You notice how easy it is when you're right-handed, you're at the top of the key, you drive to the left side. It's very easy for you to pull up when driving left and shoot a jumper. Why is that? It's because your hip and your shoulder are already in line with the basket. Now, if you're preach square and you jump straight up and straight down, then when you would drive left with your right hand and you went to go shoot, wouldn't you want to turn so that you were square? But that would, if you saw somebody do that, it would look ridiculous. Most people just drive left and pull up, and it's effortless because they're already in line because their feet and their hips are already naturally turned. The last thing is watch wheelchair basketball. If you watch wheelchair basketball, watch when they shoot free throws. I've seen one, so I'm not going to lie. There is a black swan, but I watched a lot of wheelchair basketball, and I would say like 98, 99% of every person playing wheelchair basketball, when they go to the free throw line, they are not square. They turn their wheelchair, and they do that so they can line up their shooting hip and shoulder to the basket. When I play darts, I'm not square. When I'm bowling, I'm not square. When I'm shooting a bow and arrow, I'm not square. There are a lot of other sports where I'm very rarely, if I'm squared. When I throw a football or a baseball, I'm not square. So we take this concept of square and we apply it to different fields and to different shots. And when you start, if you believe in being square, right? And you start applying it to these different shots, it just gets really ridiculous very quickly. Now, you can start square, but you don't finish square. And that's what kind of makes shooting a little bit difficult, because like I had mentioned earlier, you drive left, your right shoulder is already aligned to the basket. What makes shooting, driving to your right, difficult is that your shoulder is on the opposite side. It's away from the basket. So when you go up to shoot, you have to fully rotate anywhere from 110 to 120, 30 degrees. And that's not science or anything. That's just an estimation on my part.
So it's a further rotation.
It's a further rotation, right. Which is also, that messes up your timing when you shoot, right? So you have to practice that. You have to practice different shoulder rotations when you shoot. Like you got to practice when you're square and you turn slightly. You also have to practice when you're already in your turn. Like, your feet are just slightly angled. You got to practice like that. And then the last one, the hardest shots are when your right shoulder, your shooting shoulder is, perpendicular to the rim, and you have to turn, over 90 degrees to get it where it needs to be. Kobe, when he would drive to the right, a lot of times he would go to the short corner and then he would pull up and then he would rotate to get that shooting shoulder aligned to the baseline shot. It's a very difficult shot. It messes up the timing of the release because you have to turn. It's not impossible. It's just more difficult and takes more practice and timing.
I would agree with that 100%. I think if you look at players, and I know I can speak from experience there, that I was much more comfortable as a right-handed shooter going to my left than I was as a right-handed shooter going to my right. Mm-hmm. And so if I think about what you're describing there in terms of lining up my shoulder, I do think that there's something there when we talk about, I think if you go back and you look at the history of teaching shooting, when we talk about being square to the basket, I think there's that old school philosophy of wanting to make sure that I'm completely on balance. I'm completely, my shoulders are square to the hoop. Mm-hmm. And I think that that is, you said, if you've watched some of the best shooters in the world, they do end up aligning their shooting, their shooting side of their body ends up being much more aligned with the basket as opposed to their, both their feet being square. I do think there's something to be said for that stance.
Coaches, we've teamed up with Coach Tyler Whitcomb so you can now purchase his exclusive new playbooks right from the Hoopheads Pod website. If you're looking for ways to improve your team next season, these playbooks blend affordability with the quality content that serious coaches are looking for. Just visit hoopheadspod.com/store and you'll find playbooks from John Calipari of Kentucky, Leonard Hamilton from Florida State, and Mike Young of Virginia Tech. Check out these great resources at hoopheadspod.com/store.
Let's talk about the eyes.
Okay, so eyes. I talked about, there are three concepts with the eyes. The first is eye dominance. Okay, and that almost, sometimes that's the first thing I'll do is when I line up a new set of students, I have them test their eye dominance. And I do that multiple times so I get an accurate read. And I do that because I had a player, my best player, when I coached JV girls basketball. And there was this one time she was shooting, and she's our best player, best three-point shooter, and she's making. But I noticed when she jumps, she's jumping to the right in a diagonal way. And I talked to her and I said, Emma, you need to jump forward. Like, I don't know, you're jumping diagonal. That's weird. Jump forward. And she did. And she missed every shot. Every shot. And then I said, hey, Emma, just, I don't know, coach is an idiot, just shoot the way you were. And she started making it. And I started thinking, and then I made her do the eye dominance test, and she was cross-eye dominant. She was adjusting. She shot through her left eye, so when she jumped kind of diagonally to the right, up and to the right, what she was doing was when she would do that, the ball would then somehow line up with her left eye. And that's why she was making it. But when I corrected her, because I know best, because I'm this guru shooting coach in the early stages, I screwed up her shot because I forced her to jump straight, which meant she started shooting through her right eye. And she started clanking them really badly. And so I make all my players take the eye dominance because they're going to have a different set of principles. Either, and it's not that different. It's just you're going to either shoot through your left eye or whatever your dominant eye, your opposite eye, or you're going to bring it up more to the middle of your forehead.
What's the eye dominance test, Tim? How do I do that?
Okay, so the easiest, there's a couple different ways to do it. The way I do it is I kind of, it's on my website too, 180coaching.org. But basically, you kind of make a small triangle with your hands. So you make a small triangle. You fixate on something eye level, just a point. It can be anything. It can be my finger or a spot on the wall. And you just look at that spot on the wall, which is at your eye level, and then you straighten out your arms. You make a small triangle between your index fingers and thumbs, and then you put whatever the dot on the wall. You try to look through your hands at that dot, and then one of your eyes will take over. It's typically, most people are right-handed, right eye dominant, and you just do that a couple of times, and that'll tell you if you're right or left eye dominant. If you have any other questions, feel free to email me, 180coaching@gmail.com, or you can go on my website. You can also just type in eye dominance and do some research. There's quite a few different tests to do it, but that's the one I use.
Cool.
And the next part of eyes is, this is a big one. It's watch the flight of the ball. So, and I'm going to tell you why you do that. So watching the flight of the ball helps with your alignment, and it also helps with you with your shot depth and arc. When you watch the flight of the ball, first off, you're going to shoot it straight. Because once you get to your lift point, or once you start getting to your face region and the ball starts traveling out, like, there's nothing you can do, right? You don't need to still stare at your target because, like, the power, it's all there. But as you watch yourself shoot the ball is now going to go straight. Also, it really helps when you watch the ball because it gets you into the correct body position. You want to have a slight lean, right? A slight tilt, a slight twist, where your shoulders are back and your hips and your feet are forward. And when you're in that body position, it's very easy for you to just glance up and watch the flight of the ball. And your shoulders are relaxed. And here's the main thing. Arc is very, very important. The sweet spot with arc is 42 to 48 degrees, okay? If you stare at the rim and you jump straight up and down and you don't look at your arc, okay, how do you know if you're shooting the ball too flat? Or better yet, how do you know if you're shooting the ball too high? You have no idea what's going on above your head because you're staring at the rim and you don't know if you're shooting the ball too high, right? You don't know what's going on because the ball never enters your vision. So you don't know if you're shooting it too high, too flat. You don't even know what your arc is. So if you want to have good arc or medium arc, and why do we want to have medium arc? Well, the research shows that if you shoot between 42 and 48 degrees, that's the sweet spot. You're guaranteed to make a majority of your shots. So if I shoot the ball and I shoot it really high at 55 degrees, it swishes. If I shoot it at 56 degrees, same power, I'm clanking it off the front of the rim. At 58 degrees, I'm clanking it off the backboard, right? If I'm off 1 or 2 degrees and I shoot it high, I will swish the ball more, but I will get a splatter effect and I'll miss. It's better to shoot flat than it is to shoot high. You'll make more statistically by shooting it flat, but your best chance of making a basket is to hit that sweet spot in the middle with the medium arc. And you need to focus on that. Your training needs to be focusing on that. You need to watch the flight of the ball so you know what your arc is or have some type of idea or concept. The last part is where to look on the rim. And there's a lot of debate about this. And honestly, I just tell the players what the best spot is. And then if they want to use it, great. If they want to look at the front or back, that's okay too. Like, I'm never going to know. But I tell them that the sweet spot is 11 inches past the front of the rim. And again, I got that from NOAA Basketball. They have tons of research and data on it. And that's the sweet spot. And the reason I teach them that is because, you know, the rim is 18 inches in diameter. 9 inches is the direct center. You want to go 2 inches past the direct center. And that's the best scoring spot. You'll make the most buckets from that. And the reason I teach that is because if I tell you to stare at the back of the rim and you shoot and you're staring at the back of the rim and you hit the back of the rim and it bounces out, did you miss? You're aiming for the back of the rim, you hit the back of the rim, but now the ball bounced out. You know, I don't want a negative consequence for me hitting my target, right? It's like me playing darts. And if I hit a bullseye, I don't get the 100 points or the 50 points. I get negative 20. Like, I wouldn't, you know, it doesn't make any sense to me. Yep. That's why I want a positive. If I hit my bullseye, I want a bucket. That's why I teach that. And the numbers and the statistics back that up.
All right, the dip.
Dip goes back into, a lot of coaches, they fight me on the dip. They basically say, hey, I don't dip because I want to get my shot off. And if I dip the ball down, then I'm going to, you know, it's going to get blocked. I won't get the shot off. And I tell them the same. Whether if you dip or don't dip, it's exactly the same speed. Okay? So you might as well dip because you get added benefits of dipping. The main benefit you get of dipping is it helps you, it connects your upper and lower body. So that's the main reason why you should dip. You want to harmonize. You want a one motion shot. You want to connect your upper body mechanics with your lower body mechanics. So when I catch the ball at chest level, my knees bend down. I want the ball to dip to, you know, my waist area. Okay. As the ball goes down, my knees go down. As my knees start to come up, the ball comes up. And that helps me in timing my release. Okay. And whether I do that, I'm catching an energy wave traveling through my body. If I shoot and I don't, and I just hold the ball at my chest and I don't dip, my knees still dip down. And as they come up, I shoot. But I would shoot right when that energy wave starts to come up. I would start, once I start moving the ball up, that's the same spot if I dipped or didn't dip, because My dip is connected to my knees. So regardless if I dip or don't dip, it's this exact same amount of time. So I dip because it helps me, stay on my shot path. It connects my upper and lower body. It helps generate power. So it helps me with alignment and it helps me with power. And that's why.
I like that idea of the energy wave. I read something, it's a couple of years ago now, Clay Thompson talking about shooting. And one of the things that he said, and I think it was actually, he attributed it to his father, Michael Thompson, who at one point was the number one overall draft pick in the NBA and played for the Lakers. But they talked about the fact that they wanted it to feel like, they wanted his shot to feel like it was a flow of, they described it as like a flow of water coming up from the feet all the way up into the release of his shot, which kind of goes to the same thing that you just talked about, which is this energy wave. And you want your entire body to be working together. And when I think of that energy wave or that current of water analogy with a shot, I always think of the guys who have like a hitch in their shot, or just, it always seems like they're shooting on the way down, or they're a guy who just doesn't, every piece of his body seems to be going in different directions. He just doesn't have that smooth release. Whereas the guys who are the best shooters of all time, every single part of their body seems to be working in unison with only one goal in mind, and that's to get the ball into the basket. I know that's one of the things that when I'm working with a player on their shot, that you try to get them to understand that every movement within their body should be designed with the idea that it's helping you to get the ball into the basket. And if it's not helping you get the ball into the basket, then you should try to eliminate that motion from your shot. And that's what I hear. When I hear you saying energy wave, that's what I think of, is my entire body being riding that wave together in order to get the ball into the basket.
Correct. Because it helps you time your release. But also, like I said, it connects your upper and lower body. Because other times players with two motion shots, what they do is they do the opposite. So as their knees bend, the ball comes up. And a lot of shooting coaches unnaturally teach that, because they'll plunk their kids right in front of a basket 3 feet away, and then they'll go to their lift point and then they'll bend down and shoot. So they get used to having the ball kind of by their face when their knees down. But think about it, if you catch the ball at your chest and then your knees bend down but your arms go up, they're not in unison, they're not connected, right? Your arms are going up, your knees are going down, right? You want to connect that energy. That way it just feels better. It feels like everything, like you said, is working together, as opposed to, patting your head and rubbing your stomach, doing two different things.
There you go. Absolutely.
So,
all right, the release. Talk release.
Release. Okay. So one of the controversial things I talk about now with release is, well, let me get to the first part with the release is that, again, I preach hand on side of the ball. And basically, your shooting's a two-handed shot. And I know people don't like to hear that, but shooting takes two hands working together. Your offhand is in your shot, okay? And that's not a very popular concept, but it's 100% true. In any type of shot, your offhand doesn't just remain still and just stay there and not do anything. The main reason I have this is Steph Curry, Ray Allen, and Reggie Miller. Those are 1, 2, 3 in the NBA as far as most shots, most three-point shots, most three-point makes. Ray Allen and Reggie Miller both flick or rotate their palm when they shoot, and Steph Curry does a thumb flick. I think your offhand, it has minimal guidance, but it moves and it helps the shot. And they work together, okay? Because when your hand is on the side of the ball, as the ball comes up and your palm starts to rotate, your left hand must also rotate to be kind of where your palms are facing each other, so that your palm on your offhand starts getting more towards the top of the ball. And then as your palm rotates and goes into your release, you get a thumb push, you get a thumb flick. At the very least, your offhand should not, your fingers should not be pointing straight up. At the very least, they should rotate forward and your fingers should point towards the basket if there is no thumb flick. But I like the thumb flick.
I was a thumb flick shooter.
Yeah.
When I played, and I'm not sure that if I go back and think about the amount of time that I spent practicing, I always think it's interesting because that's one of the things that I go back and forth on, because I myself use the thumb flick. And then mm-hmm. I know that there are some other shooters that I've seen that are very good shooters that I don't necessarily, they tend to have more of a flat guide hand. Mm-hmm. So I think about myself as a shooter and wonder that, you know, hey, if I had eliminated that thumb flick, could I have been even more consistent than I was? Could I have been a better shooter than I was? Well, and what I hear you saying is, in your mind, mm-hmm. the thumb flick is not an issue. So maybe explain why you think it's a benefit, or at least not a negative issue.
Okay, I will give you the best reason. Okay, so out of the whole league, the NBA, and I'm even going to include the WNBA, there have been 8 NBA players that are 180 shooters, meaning they shot 50% from the two-point field goals, 40% from threes, and 90% from the free throw line. Okay, they're Larry Bird, Malcolm Brogdon, Steph Curry, Kevin Durant, Reggie Miller, Steve Nash, Dirk, and Mark Price. The 9th player is in the WNBA, Elena Deladon. And those are 9 players. Those are the only 9 players that have ever done that feat. Okay? Let's count how many flick their thumb or rotate their offhand. Larry Bird does. Malcolm Brogdon thumb flicks. Larry Bird rotates his palm. Steph Curry thumb flick. Reggie Miller rotates his palm on his offhand. Dirk flicks his thumb. And Elena Deladon, she flicks her thumb as well. So out of those 9 players that have accomplished this very rare feat at their profession, 6 use their offhands. The only ones that don't are Mark Price, Steve Nash, and Kevin Durant. But Durant does rotate his offhand forward so that his fingers are pointing towards the basket. But he doesn't really influence it. They just go forward. And I agree with that as well. But 66% of the best shooters of all time do that. And nobody puts up the volume that Steph Curry does. Like, he's in a category of by himself. Because I know all the shooting coaches, they love to go to Clay because he really symbolizes the old school way of coaching. But Clay is not as good as Steph, okay? Steph shoots more threes, and he makes a higher percentage. He's led the league in three-point shooting like 3 or 4 years in a row. He's a 2-time MVP, and he's 3rd all-time in shooting. The year he went as a 180 shooter, he shot 10 to 11 threes a game and shot 45%. So no one puts up the volume that he does. And when you put up that volume, you should be shooting a lower percentage. Steph is number 1 for his career as far as highest shooting percentage, and he shoots the most. The only person that comes close is James Harden. But Harden has, I think, had a few years where he averaged more than 10 shots per game, but he shoots like 36% over his career, and where Steph is at 43%. So there's something he's doing right and things that he's doing in his mechanics that nobody else is doing. And you have to acknowledge that. By when you push with your thumb, you get extra power, not much. But when you point your fingers towards the rim, the main thing you get, as opposed to what Thompson does, is when you point your fingers towards the basket, you use the whole length of your hand. From the bottom of your palm to the tip of your middle finger, that's a runway that helps you guide the ball straight. Whereas if your fingers are pointing straight up, your runway is cut in half because it's just the width of your palm. So there's some technique to why you want to do that. Back to your shooting hand, you want to rotate your palm and you want to do 70% off of maximum. So when you shoot, it's just 70%. And your wrist, you never snap your wrist. It just flops down 4 fingers. And the reason I do 4 fingers is because Steph does 4 fingers. KD does 4 fingers. Klay does 4 fingers. Ray Allen does 4 fingers. Kyle Korver does 4 fingers. You know, J.J. Redick does 4 fingers. Well, J.J. kind of snaps. You know, Reggie Miller, all the great guys, they all do that 4-finger release. So that's why I teach it, that's what they do. That's what works for them. Multiple players do it. So I'll do that.
So when you say a four-finger release, you're talking about the four fingers being pointed down and the thumb correct. Sort of being pointed to the side.
Yeah, like it's just really floppy. You're not really got it. You're extending the elbow out, and the fingers are just naturally bouncing and flopping gotcha. Down. But you don't gotcha. Snap, because snapping, you can snap harder or softer on a given day. But when you extend the elbow out and the hand just naturally bounces and just kind of flops, that's consistency to your shot. That's why you don't want to snap. Because one day you might be snapping it really hard and getting a lot of rotation, but maybe at the end of the game, you're tired and that snap's not as hard. You know, you want a consistent shot, a repeatable, consistent shot that you can do over and over again. And and you do that on a hook shot. You know what I'm saying? A hook shot, you're not concerned about the finger. It's a four finger release down. Same thing with other shots as well.
Hey everyone, last year at the Junior NBA Summit, I came across an amazing company called iSport 360 and its founder, Ian Goldberg. Their youth sports app gets coaches, players, and parents on the same page. Your team can set goals, share player feedback, training videos, sticker rewards, player evals, and practice assignments. All of this to foster a healthy team communication and culture. If your team or club struggles to keep open lines of communication, especially among team parents, iSport 360 can help. If you want to empower your athletes to have more success, more confidence, and more communication with their teammates, give iSport 360 a try today. Shoot me an email, mike@hoopheadspod.com, or give me a call at 216-392-4059 to learn more.
I think what you just said there with a consistent, repeatable shot is key. And I think within anybody who's teaching shooting, I think the important thing that I hear from any shooting coach, regardless of what their philosophy is that what you do has to be repeatable and it has to be comfortable. And within any of these particular things, I think there is some individual variance within each player as long as you're following these same basic concepts that you're teaching. I love all the different little teaching points that you're making, because as you go through and you talk about these, I think it gets a player or a coach to think about what it is that they're doing and what they're teaching. And I love that you have a why behind it. It's not just you guessing about what works. Mm-hmm. It's you having looked at people who are actually shooting the ball and having success, and then try to take the skills that they've developed, the technique that they've developed, and then pass that on to the players that you're working with. So let's go to the sweep and sway. Talk a little bit about that.
Yeah, the sweep and sway, which also consists of a turn, right? I sweep and sway, body tilt, you know, turn, twist. These are all words that describe the same action. I just use the sweep and sway because it's very widely known that basically you want to jump forward and your shoulders want to go back and your hips want to go and your feet want to go forward. You do this for several reasons. You do it mainly. The first thing is when your shoulders are back, you have less tension on your shoulders. So when I take a player, I go, especially young players, they jump forward with their shoulders forward in the beginning stages of their career. And what I say is I tell my players, hey, everybody lean a little bit forward. Now pick up your shooting arm. Try to pick it up straight. Lean forward at 45 degree angle and try to pick up your arms. And now I say, now lean back. Now pick up your arm. You see the range of motion? You see how different that is? That's why we don't jump forward and have our shoulders forward when we shoot. You want your shoulders back. And you also want to turn in the air, because that rotation, when you turn, gives you power. Now, your release in your sweep and sway with the turn, that helps you shoot the ball. So think about this. My hand's on the side of the ball, okay? And as I'm jumping forward, my body, my shoulder are also starting to turn, and I'm starting to lean back. And as my palm rotates to the basket, my shooting hip and shooting shoulder start rotating to the basket. It's going to be very hard for me to miss left and right if my palm, my shoulder, and my hip are all turning towards the center of the rim. It's like me shooting a rifle. Inside the barrel, it's grooved. So when the bullet comes out, it has a rotation so it goes straighter and further. And that's the same thing when I'm shooting a basketball. I'm turning my hips, I'm turning my shoulder, I'm turning my palm. They're all rotating to the same target. And it's very, very difficult to miss left and right when all of those things are happening.
I think that's one of the concepts that has become at least somewhat more accepted when you watch players shoot and you really study them. I think that it's becoming a much more commonly taught practice that players are not going to, you know, the old adage was you jump up and land in the exact same spot that you took off from. If I think about
what coaches
used to tell me, you know, 35 years ago, that was probably what you were hearing more than anything when it came to shooting. Mm-hmm. And now clearly we know that players don't end up shooting that way. And it goes to all the things, just the progression that you just went through. Each step leads to the next one in terms of one affects the next, which affects the next, which affects the next. And so if you look at that entire progression, you see that by the time you end up releasing your shot, you're going to end up with that sweep and sway. You're going to end up with that turn where you're not going to end up landing with your feet completely pointed directly towards the basket. And I think that that's something, again, you think about the old school method of teaching versus the way that you're talking about and the way you're describing it and the way that a lot of coaches are starting to come around to teaching. I think there's a lot of merit to that. And again, like I said earlier, what you're basing your coaching techniques with when it comes to shooting is not just you guessing out of nowhere. It's you going and doing the film study and putting in the time. And I think that's important for everybody to understand is if you go and you watch the best shooters in the world, then you're going to be able to see some of the things that Tim's talking about here tonight. Is there anything else you want to talk about in that front? Because then I want to get to a little bit of the 1-2 step versus the hop before we wrap things up.
Yeah, just one thing, just one 2 points. One is that also when you sweep and sway, you have better arc because by having that body position with your shoulders back, it makes it easier for you to look at the ball. And if you jump straight up and down, you have to jerk your head up to see the flight of the ball, and you don't want to do that. Also, when you shoot from distance, you don't sweep and sway. You just turn. But that's because your lift point is usually below your eye. Because when you shoot 5 feet behind the three-point line in the NBA, you're going to shoot, you know, below your eye. And at that point, you don't need to sweep and sway because your arc, because you're shooting a flatter shot, but since it's from greater distance, you don't need to shoot it that high. And you need the power. So you just turn. You just turn. And the further you go out, the less you have to sweep and sway to a certain extent, and the more you just turn. So when you see players like Steph or Damian Lillard or LeBron or whomever shoot somewhere between half court and the three-point line, you'll notice that their lift point is lower and that they don't sweep and sway, but they still have great arc because they're so far away.
Understood. All right, let's talk 1-2 versus the hop. Just give us a little bit of your philosophy. I know that you believe that it depends on circumstance. So just talk a little about the benefits and how you teach those two things and what your philosophy is.
Yeah, I mean, basically it's based, I base it on speed. That's my main thing. But it's not that you can't hop going sprinting. It's just something that has to be trained, and it's more difficult to do. Usually if you're coming off a double screen and you're sprinting with someone chasing you, it's going to be easier for you to do a 1-2 step into that to kind of slow down your momentums and then shoot. If you hop, you can still do it, but you're probably going to drift or float because your momentum is going to carry you into that. Both need to be practiced. The hop is a better technique because you will get the shot off faster. So it's really, how good do you want to be? You know, that's, I always pose the question to my players, how good do you want to be? Look, you might be able to get away with the 1-2, but as you go up in levels, the players are going to get bigger and faster, and you might need to get this shot off a half second or a second faster, and you're going to need to do the hop. So you can practice it now and, or don't practice it and have to practice it later if you go up to that level. But it's good to know both, and usually speed determines it for the most part, but, you know, the hop is a more efficient technique.
Yeah, I think there's something to be said there for both techniques. Mm-hmm. I think if you have both of them in your bag, I think you're going to be better off because obviously there are circumstances, no matter what level of basketball you're playing at, where you may be doing one or the other, or one or the other may be more beneficial. I do agree with you 100% that the hop allows you to get your shot off faster. We actually had Dave Love on here who, this was probably, Dave was on, I don't know, 6-8 months ago maybe. Mm-hmm. And one of the things that Dave talked about with us that got me to sort of think about this in a different way is I was talking about how, especially with young kids, I always taught them the 1-2 step because I said I felt like kids with the 1-2 step had better balance and they were able to generate more power on their shot shooting with the 1-2. And Dave said, well, have you ever asked the kids how they feel about it and how it works for them? And I said, well, no, not really. I kind of guess just went on my own experience. And so that got me really thinking about the difference between the two and why I taught what I taught. And since that conversation, I've really started to think about and give kids more of an option of, hey, which one feels more comfortable to you right now? Let's work on that one. And then once you get the one that you feel more comfortable doing down, then we can start to add the other one to your arsenal. And I think if you have both in your bag of tricks as a shooter, you're going to be that much better off than the player who focuses solely on one or the other.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And most of the best shooters do it and they do it. There are ways to do it. One of the newer techniques is that when you're coming off full speed and you're coming off your both feet or you're doing the hop, you'll notice that a lot of players, you see this most in the NBA and college, they spread their legs really wide, almost like a Y. And they do that because they have to rotate typically. And with that, when you spread your legs extra wide, when you're going at that speed, it slows you down. So it's almost like an air brake. So when you spread your legs wide, when you shoot, it kind of slows you down in the air. So it's, you know, less for you to adjust when you shoot. So that's kind of a little tip or a tidbit to just pay attention to when you see the best shooters on the planet shoot. A lot of times when they hop, coming off full speed, they spread their legs wide in the air to kind of to mediate and to kind of to soften the spin and kind of air brake system. I guess that's the best way I can put it.
Yeah, it's a good description. And I'll go back to what I've said a couple times now. By taking the time to study the film and really look at what guys are doing, I think it gives you a much better base from which to teach. And I'm not sure that every coach out there is taking the time to do the analysis and this film study that you've done to be able to put together a solid philosophy of how you're trying to teach. I want to start to wrap up here, yep. Tim, by giving you a chance to share how people can get in touch with you. If they want to reach out, they want to learn more about what you're doing, if they're in your local area, if they want to come out and train with you in any way. So give people a way that they can reach out to you, give us your website, all that stuff, social media. And then if there's anything that we didn't hit on, you want to make one little final parting shot, go ahead and do that. And then I'll jump back in and wrap up the episode.
Okay. Yeah. I'm in Orange County, California. You feel free to go to my website, 180coaching.org. There's all my philosophies written out, shot breakdowns, shots of underhand free throws, free throw attempts, the mental side. I actually have drills that break down each one of these concepts, and they're all short drills. They're all like a minute or shorter, sometimes 20 seconds. They just show you the drill and they say, hey, this is to work on your stance. This works on your dip. These drills work on your sweep and sway. And you can find all that information. You can reach me on the website. My email address is 180coaching@gmail.com. You can also get me on Instagram at 180coaching. Feel free to contact me. If you're in the Orange County, California area, I'd be more than happy to work with you. Feel free to reach out and schedule a lesson.
Tim, we can't thank you enough for spending some time with us tonight. It's been very informative. I think coaches that are out there that teach shooting and are looking for innovative ways to be able to help their players improve their shot, we're able to get a lot out of the episode. And we can't thank you enough for spending that time with us tonight. And to everyone out there, we will catch you on our next episode. Thanks. Registration is now open at headstartbasketball.com for this summer's Head Start Basketball Camps. We'll be hosting camps for boys and girls in grades 1-6 throughout the greater Cleveland area. Get registered today and make sure you hit the courts with us this summer. Being without basketball right now is tough for all of us. so we've partnered with Pro Skills Basketball to offer you a 50% discount on their Ultimate Shooting Guide and Video Program that will put players on a guided path to becoming the best shooter they can be. With 1 year's worth of workouts that includes games, drills, and competitions, players will gain access to a blueprint showing them what it takes to become an elite-level shooter. If you're looking to improve your shooting at home, this program can help. Visit hoopheadspod.com/store to check it out.
Thanks for listening to the Hoopheads Podcast, presented by Head Start Basketball.